Hi, this is Alex C. Talander, and welcome to episode 28 of Book Banter. This episode is brought to you by EastBayFootLocker.com. East Bay and Foot Locker are a leading world supplier of athletic footwear, apparel, and sports equipment, featuring top athletic brands such as Adidas, Reebok, and Nike. To receive 50% off any order at East Bay, go to EastBay.com and use the custom code AFBOOK15, or to receive 15% off any order at Foot Locker, go to footlocker.com and use the custom code AFBOOKFL. And in this episode, you'll be hearing my interview with Kim Stanley Robinson, who is the author of the award-winning Mars Trilogy, as well as a number of other books. We'll be talking about his latest book, Galileo's Dream. We'll begin first with my review for Galileo's Dream, which will be followed by my interview with Kim Stanley Robinson. And then we'll move on to the book review portion of the episode, which will be started with A Local Habitation by Shauna Maguire, and that's the second in her October Day series, which will be followed by The Burning Land by Bernard Cornwell, part of his Saxon Tales, and we'll be ending with Carrion Comfort by Dan Simmons. But first, we begin with my review for Galileo's Dream by Kim Stanley Robinson. Kim Stanley Robinson tries something different to his usual classic science fiction novels in Galileo's Dream, employing a combined story of Galileo's life as a scientist with an unusual setup on a moon of Saturn in the distant future. The result is an incredible novel that employs all of the great styles and abilities that Robinson has to offer, with his complex, developed writing style, the excellent research, the hard science fiction, and an incredible, unique story. Galileo's Dream essentially has two storylines going on that involve Galileo Galilei. One is the moving story of Galileo's life in becoming a hard scientist, scrutinizing everything, researching and learning, coming up with new inventions, and studying the heavens every day. As his popularity grows and his ideas and theories on the Copernican idea of the universe, that everything does not revolve around the Earth, but that the planets revolve around the Sun, turn to proven facts in his mind and he tries to publish works claiming this, he begins to feel the wrath of the Church, and more importantly the Pope, who he thought would be an ally and is instead turning into an adversary. The other story to Galileo's Dream is when Galileo uses his recently invented telescope with superior lenses. He discovers the moons of Jupiter, which are known as the Galilean moons, and in a moment is magically transported from the 17th century to the year 3020 on the moon of Europa, where he must help the strange-looking inhabitants with their own problems. Each time he is transported back to his time, he remembers a little more of his forays into the distant future. Galileo's Dream is a unique story that could only have been conceived of in the mind of Kim Stanley Robinson, taking the reader on a journey they won't soon forget as they learn about the incredible life of someone often referred to as the world's first scientist, as well as being entertained by an engrossing science fiction story set in the 31st century. And before we move on to my interview with Kim Stanley Robinson, I would just like to thank Sunny and the Avid Reader Bookstore in Davis for helping to organize and host the interview for Book Banter. And now my interview with Kim Stanley Robinson.
First off, thanks for doing the interview.
Pleasure.
My first question is, so Galileo's Dream is quite a different novel from your other books, combining science fiction with kind of a biography of Galileo. What made you want to write Galileo's Dream?
Well, I had done research on the scientific revolution when I was doing the research for my book, The Years of Ice and Salt, mm-hmm. where I made up an alternative science fiction revolution somewhere else. And the real one struck me as very interesting, and one of the main points of interest in how it really happened was Galileo himself. So I put that thought aside, because that was many years ago, 10 years ago.
Right.
And then at some point in the last 5 years, I had this image of Galileo looking through his telescope and shooting through it up to the moons of Galileo to some future time that people had the power to drag him off like that. And it was a strange image, but it struck me as a hook for the story. And so I pursued that, and that's how it started.
So how true is Galileo's recorded life in Galileo's Dream? Is it pretty accurate to point out?
It's absolutely accurate. I used a lot of his own letters and the letters of people who wrote to him. His life is very well documented. And I didn't want to change anything. Mm-hmm. I thought that would be a bad move, and sort of the thing that doesn't happen in the book is for things to be different from now. But it takes a little bit of work in the book to get to now. to get to our timeline is a bit of a struggle on the part of the time traveling people struggling over how history is going to go. So everything I say about Galileo's life, it happened just as it happened, including all the strange
people. Use all the quotations too, and stuff like that.
And also they had, it was almost like this tape recorder here, during his trial they had a nun taking a stenography, and they had tremendous, like a transcript of the trial, which is a very rare thing from the Renaissance, to have conversation being recorded word for word for hours on end. Well, that was tremendous to have to use.
Another primary source,
it's beautiful.
So, yes, you've got kind of like two stories going on where you've got Galileo and when he's pulled into the future, then Galileo in his life.
Mm-hmm.
Were these, like how you wrote it, did you write it just as a straight story, or were these kind of two separate stories in your mind at all? Or?
No, not at all. I mean, they bounce off each other. Mm-hmm. The story of Galileo off in the future is him getting ensnarled in some things that are happening there in the future, but also them interfering in his life to the point of getting... it's a struggle to get to the history that we know is what it comes down to, although I'm blowing some surprises here. So the two are knitted together, and I definitely wrote it roughly in the order that you see in the novel, because it was an ongoing story to try to make everything fall out as it did in this world.
And so I'm guessing you did a lot of research for it?
Sure, but, you know, it wasn't... as bad as the Year of Ice and Salt in research terms. It was a lot of fun, and the Galileo literature in English is just like one long bookcase, and it's all interesting stuff. From people who are apologists for the church persecuting him, to people who have theories as to why they did it, and then arguments of the scientific work, and the things about his daughter, and so it went on and on, but it was all very interesting.
Now, in your books, you tend to have a lot of like technical details with hard science. Is this something you have a background in, or is it something you kind of just research for your life?
Yeah, I'm an English major, so my college work was in literature. And I'm married to a scientist, and I'm interested in scientists. I hung out with them socially a lot and studied it a lot for the various projects that I've written about. And the thing is that, you know, in science fiction novels, the equations are not there. The math is not there. It always comes down to interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
So what you need then is to be somewhat like the way a science journalist would work. You have to be good at explaining what the concepts mean in English that other people don't understand.
Right.
And that's a different trick than knowing the math.
Right. So in 1992, the Vatican formally acknowledged that the errors committed by the Church Tribunal against Galileo. Why do you think it took them this long, and were you surprised that it happened at all?
It took a long time because for a long time it was a point of pride that Vatican wasn't into announcing that it had made mistakes in the past. That papal infallibility was taken seriously, and it looked like it was the Pope's decision, and it was a political issue in Italy because Galileo was always a symbol of the left and of resistance to the church, naturally, including the Italian Communist Party in the 1920s and 30s, big time. And then the Vatican has always been on the side of the Italian right. There's just no way, because it's a political issue. On the other hand, it was getting to be an embarrassment, and especially with the space photos. When you finally had pictures, you know, of Earth from the moon out there in space. Then, and it took John Paul II, and it took one of the anniversaries. 92 was not that significant of an anniversary, but it had been coming on 400 years. For some reason, John Paul II decided it would be a good decision to do. Now, this Pope Benedict they have now, he would never have done it. It is even making ominous-sounding noises about how actually the trial was right, etc.
What I was trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, what do you hope readers get from reading Galileo's Dream?
Well, I hope they get the sense of how science is a human construct and something that we've made up, and how what a big figure at the start of Galileo was, to remember him. And also that it's not just about the telescope, it's about the beginning of physics and about experimental science. scientific method, and that we all live by it even if we don't understand or acknowledge that fact that we live in a scientific world, and that he was at the start of it. And then, you know, to try to make people think hard about science as a kind of a religion, this religion-science dichotomy, and how it is, in some ways it isn't necessary, in other ways, in some ways they're complementary. So that by reading this book, is certainly in your face, these issues. And the book doesn't make conclusions for you, because the situation is complicated.
And still very.
Yeah,
a lot. Now, yeah.
Good yeah. Point. But it brings up all these issues, I think, in an interesting and fun story. I liked it because it was a strange idea. I mean, it's been called strange and bizarre in reviews of the book, but risky, etc. But on the other hand, it's not like other books. There's something for everybody to dislike, and so people get to choose whether they like the historical or whether they like the science fiction, and try to divide them up as if they are one story, and talk about Galileo. So I thought that he was such an amazing figure that it would be fun just as a portrait to him.
Mm-hmm. So what made you decide to become a writer?
Oh, I don't know. I love to read. Mm-hmm. When I was very young, I took to reading, and I've been in love with reading novels and poetry and anything ever since. But particularly fiction and poetry. So when I got older, I started trying it myself. And, you know, I grew up in an agricultural community that got rapidly, rapidly urbanized.
Mm-hmm.
Orange County was orange groves, and then it
right.
was a city. It all happened right in front of my young eyes. And, you know, I didn't care at the time. It was like a blur, because young people don't think at that level. But I do think what happened was when I ran into science fiction later, that it seemed super familiar to me. It seemed accurate. You know, it was like, oh, well, this is the story where I came from.
Right.
And I recognized it and thought, well, this is just realism. This isn't crazy stuff. This is what really happens. So I've been a big advocate of science fiction, a fan and a writer, and generally I live in the world of science fiction in my professional career. I think because of that.
And can you name some of your influences?
Well, when I started reading science fiction, the new wave was happening, and it was exciting to have these new books coming out. This is the early 70s. So those people still matter the most to me, like Ursula Le Guin or Samuel Delaney, Gene Wolfe, Joanna Russ, Stanislaw Lem, Thomas Dish. It was a whole crowd. And almost everybody doing work between, say, 65 and 75 was boggling my mind. It was a great crowd. And so they were all influential. I think if I could do what they did, I would be happy. Because they brought science fiction to a much higher level
right.
than it had been before. With a lot of attentiveness to our world and a lot of metaphorical applications to our world that are very important for science fiction to have. Because otherwise, it can become like a crossword puzzle, a kind of a mental exercise for fun, with too much theory, not enough emotion.
But it's not grounded in some way, yeah.
Yeah, and not emotional enough as art. So the new wave, there was no problem with their emotional, they were all turned up to 11. So, and then also I have to mention, though, Gary Snyder, because he was a Davis professor.
Oh, right, yeah.
It was really when I was in Davis that I met him, and I'd already read him, and he had a huge impact on me, because I started life as a poet when I was very young. And so meeting Snyder here and getting to work with him here, that was hugely influential, and even before that.
So, do you have a set writing schedule you keep to every day?
Sure. When I am working on a novel, then what I do is get up and get the family off to work and school, and then do my email and maybe visit the garden, and then I write. And I try to do that Monday through Friday and just treat it like any other job. It's very labor-intensive, it's very time-intensive. So if you don't put in the hours, then novels don't get written. And so I have to pound the keys. So now, there are times when I'm not writing a novel, and then I'm kind of on vacation, or I dither and I write nonfiction. It's not as satisfying or as regular as scheduling.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned hitting the keys. What do you use to write on?
Now I'm writing on a Macintosh laptop, a nice new one that my wife got me. I used to write all my first drafts by hand and then transfer them into the computer to fool around with. And in a way, I think I might do that again for certain books. But when I'm getting used to just typing right into the computer.
Do you ever think you'll write in another genre, or are you going to...
Yes, I will write in other genres because I already have. Mm-hmm. Essentially, these historical novels, The Years of Rise and Fall of Galileo, are both historical novels, but they grafted into them huge science fiction elements.
I didn't really finish, but do you tend to categorize yourself then as a science fiction?
I do.
Science fiction,
of myself as a science fiction writer, mm-hmm. and that's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with my own... literary politics and my own aesthetic stance. Mm-hmm. I think we live in a science fiction novel, and I'm proud to be there myself. I think it's a way to be realistic nowadays. So I'm an advocate of it. But then also, it's a practicality of the publishing category.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, when you get off of the front shelves of the bookstore, like after the first month my book is out, then when the bookstore people think, well, where do we put this guy? Then they know where to put me. I'll always go in the science fiction section. And, you know, I could write a novel. I have a few ideas for what are essentially historical novels. They would end up with my other books. And if I wrote a mainstream novel, which I kind of did with 40 Signs of Rain, if I had been a mainstream writer and people would have put it in the regular fiction section, it would have fit perfectly well. Only a few years ahead of the game when I wrote it, and now it's a few years behind. The 40 Signs of Rain is like a historical novel. So I'm a science fiction writer, and I'm stuck with it for life, but it's not a bad fate.
Are you working on a new novel?
I am. Yes, I'm pleased to say I am, because it's been a long time since I've finished Galileo, and yet I just recently began a new one. So, it's back out in the solar system. It's kind of going back to what I did in the 90s and
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't. I mean, we know a lot more now.
Yeah.
About what might happen and how it could work. And so I have some new ideas and ways to play the game in a different way.
And have any of your books been optioned or made into movies?
Red Mar's been optioned multiple times, but it just came to a bad end once again. That's a third time it's been optioned passed on. And the person this time who wrote the screenplay is desperate to try it somewhere else again. But I'm not so sure that one is the right one. And there's interest in others and options for others, but nothing has gotten past that first stage.
Do you have any hobbies?
Sure, I sure do. I'm a gardener. In Davis, I have a vegetable garden.
Mm-hmm.
My wife comes from the East Coast, and we still have a summer place on the coast of Maine, and there I have flower garden perennials.
Do you bring any vegetables to the Davis market?
No, I don't sell them. They're for family consumption. Mm-hmm. I grow to the family's needs, more or less. But I thoroughly enjoy that, and then I do sports here in town. And I spend a lot of time, as much time as I can, hiking in Sierra Nevada. Spending time in the mountains is my main hobby, I guess you'd say.
More Gary Snyder influences.
Yeah, that was big when we started, and now it has a momentum of its own.
Mm-hmm. So, you mentioned you liked reading a lot, and you mentioned some of the books you liked to read, kind of genre.
When I was a kid?
Or just now, in general.
Oh, sure. I sure can. I like... to try to skim the history of the novel and get the good ones from the English tradition, the American tradition, and then what's been translated into English from around the world, and make sure that I've tried all the writers that people say are good,
mm-hmm.
and I have a variable reaction to them, either intense affection or ranging from that to I just don't care or even dislike it, and so. There's more books than you can read in your lifetime,
yep.
So I am very picky, and if I like a writer, then I'll tend to read everything by them,
mm-hmm.
Or at tons, and get a sense of their whole career and the shapes of their thinking through the years, and also study them as novels. So I have odd favorites, obscure favorites, and then some of the obvious guys. And I I read a lot of novels from all over, and I do try to keep track of science fiction, but not in a way that's comprehensive at all. I tend to read my old New Wave maestros that are still working, most of them. And then some of my contemporaries who are friends, who are doing great work. I have a very talented friends in the science fiction field from my own generation. I'm just keeping up their work is a fair bit of reading also. And then I also try to read a little bit of poetry, like last thing, a few poems per night before I fall asleep. So I'm always getting through one poetry collection every 6 months or so. And I just discovered this incredible poet who was kind of forgotten in the 20th century, named William Bronck. And his ancestors were the Dutch that founded the Bronx in New York. So this Bronck was a Hudson Valley poet, and his poems are just phenomenal and great, and he's kind of obscure. That's a lovely combination when you feel like there's somebody who is particularly fine that you are helping to keep their work alive because they never got their full view.
Right.
A Bronck, I think, luckily there's kind of these restoration projects. Library of America. People will get an enthusiasm and they'll bring out the complete works of somebody and they'll get a little resurgence later on. If they're lucky, they'll have a Melville phenomenon. Melville was absolutely forgotten.
Right.
I mean, utterly forgotten. While he was alive, he was forgotten.
Yeah.
And then until the 1920s, so he had been dead some 40 years. And then suddenly people understood and he was brought back in, as a major part of our canon. Well, I have faith that Bronck was so good that give it another 100 years and people would say Wallace Stevens, William Bronck, Emily Dickinson.
Will come back.
Yeah, and nobody will notice the discrepancy in this huge time away.
So thinking of all the books you've written, do you think there's a message or a point that you've been trying to get across to readers or perhaps a question you've been trying to answer?
At this point, there are many of my books that are, in one way or another, utopian novels. That's unusual, and as a distinguishing characteristic, a strangeness in my work. If you want to be a novelist, there's a certain fidelity to the real. There's an aesthetic to the novel that says, look, this is the way the world is, and I am a camera, I'm telling you what life is like. And when you read my sentences, you say, well, yeah, I never thought it'd be that way before, but that's the way life is. And that's a beautiful feeling. I read for that myself at novels. So the utopia is this different tradition that comes from these space cadets who are saying, like, blueprints for a better society. Mm-hmm. From Thomas More on, utopia has often been a kind of a tour. Well, it would be better if we did this, and it would be better if we did that, and on. And those are odd books. You could probably name the famous ones that have lasted in human memory after their date of composition. You could name them on two hands, or maybe two hands and your toes, and you'd have the whole damn literature from Thomas More on. And it's never been very plausible as fiction either, because you keep thinking, well, that people don't act like that. So the utopian novel is a cross-genre, and people are all talking now about cross-genres, like for, you know, vampires and historicals.
Yep.
Well, the utopian novel is a cross-genre in and of itself that has to do with Robert Graves and Huxley and H.G. Wells for sure, starting things off. And now Ursula Le Guin, very important figure, right before me in a new way, doing a novel like The Dispossessed, that is an interesting and powerful novel and feels real, and yet it also has all these utopian ideas in it. And she was following up a bit on Robert Graves and Aldous Huxley and H.G. Wells. And so I'm following in that tradition. Cross-genre, very hard to be both realistic and positive and suggestive of different alternative politics. And there's Delaney and Marge Piercy. It was actually kind of a thing, Joanna Russ. It was a thing in the 70s to do utopian novels and have them be... It was a way that science fiction could be just something other than just party games, intellectual tricks, but be suggestive of true difference in the future.
And then for my last question, so from the initial idea to the end of the book tour, what's your favorite part of the writing publishing process?
There's no question that it's the daily work in the middle of a novel. Anything from where I'm in a state where I can't really remember where it began, and I don't have any expectation of it ever again, because they take a long time. And in that period of time, it's just part of daily life where I'm struggling with this monster, kind of like wrestling a giant every day. And my stretches of work, like 3 or 4 hours, will pass as if they're a half hour mentally. And that's the best part. There's no question about it.
Okay.
Nothing else even comes close.
Okay, well, thank you very much for doing the interview.
Yeah, you bet.
And that was author Kim Stanley Robinson. And next, we move on to my book review for A Local Habitation by Seanan McGuire. Ace Fairy Private Eye October Day is back with her second mystery to solve, and this one's a doozy. As Toby tries to settle down, licking her wounds from her last escapades in Rosemary and Rue, she is asked by her liege, the Duke Sylvester Torkil of the Shadowed Hills, to check on his niece, Countess January O'Leary, in the country of Tame Lightning, better known as Fremont, as he hasn't heard from her in some time. Taking a sidekick along, Quentin, to show him the ropes, she finds herself caught up in way more than she bargained for. Arriving at Tame Lightning, Toby finds what appears to be a simple company that produces computer fantasy games, except that all the employees aren't human. In fact, there's not a single regular human that works there. Then there's the quiet way everyone acts around her, as if they're hiding something. Then the first person turns up dead. As Toby unravels the mystery, it turns out bodies have been piling up. When she tastes their blood to find out what happened to them, she gets nothing. They're empty husks with no story to tell of their demise. The mystery goes further when Toby finds herself under attack from something or someone. A Local Habitation is a great sequel to Rosemary and Rue, ratcheting up the action and fear as Toby once again finds herself fighting for her life, as readers learn more of the complexities of this world that Seanan McGuire has created. The good news is, after finishing A Local Habitation, as readers attempt to catch their breaths, they won't have to wait long, with an artificial light to add in September. And now we move on to The Burning Land by Bernard Cornwell. In this fifth installment of Bernard Cornwell's Saxon Tales, as he reveals the incredible life of Alfred the Great and the world of Viking England, he doesn't hold back, putting his hero Uhtred through every trial and tribulation possible. Uhtred finds himself being tested by Alfred, by the priest because of his pagan beliefs, by his Viking friends, and by his Saxon friends. Compared to the last four books of this series, The Burning Land has a lot more going on, as the end appears to be in sight for Alfred, for Uhtred, and for Cornwall. England is still in a shambles, as hordes of Vikings march across the land, taking towns and slaughtering people, while Alfred defends his small domain in the south. Alfred has become pious in his old age, turning to priests for advice and suggestions, which just infuriates Uhtred. Each time he turns to the man for the final advice on what battle to choose and where to fight, and each time Uhtred leads him to victories, but he never makes it into the tales and stories recorded by the priests. Cornwell is making a point here that we shouldn't believe everything of the sources we read, that often reality is very different to what is recorded. But Uhtred finds himself torn, owing allegiance to Alfred, but also wishing to join the Vikings up north in an effort to take back his land, Bebbanburg, taken by his uncle. For some time he does fight with the Vikings, putting fear in the heart of the Saxons to the south, as Alfred is rumored to be very ill and possibly dead. In the new year, the rumors are proved otherwise, and Uhtred returns to his lord and fights for him once more. But time is passing. Arthur grows older and sicker, while Uhtred draws closer to fighting for his homeland. There can't be too many books left in the Saxon Tales, as Cornwell brings the series to a close in the next book or two. One wonders how it will end for Alfred, and how Uhtred will fare. And now we move on to the last review of the episode, which was recently published in a new edition, Carrion Comfort by Dan Simmons. One of the greatest violations humans can imagine experiencing is not being able to control themselves. This is what is at the heart of Dan Simmons' Carrion Comfort. There is a secret society that has this ability, to control others, both mentally and physically, trapping their personality and will, and doing with them as they please. It is their power, but it is also what sustains them, what keeps them alive and living through the decades. They feed off the power to control and overpower. It has become a game to them, where each year they compete to see who can control the most. Only now, members of this secret society are being assassinated, while clues are leaking out about its existence. Dan Simmons does what he does best, creating a compelling epic that defies the imagination and takes readers on a unique journey across time and space and the many places of the planet. Carrion Comfort is an incredible in-depth piece of work on freedom and control, and what it feels like when these facets of our humanity are taken away. And that concludes this episode of Book Banter. Thank you very much for joining me, and I'll hope you'll be listening next time on April 2nd, where I will be interviewing the creators, writers, and artists of the very successful Penny Arcade comic. Coupled with this will also be a site upgrade, so you'll get to see all the new features on the site come April 2nd. For now, be sure to check out bookbanter.net for more reviews, and I'll see you next time on April 2nd. Thanks for listening.